Lecture 8, Temptation, Struggle, and Choice. The Space Trilogy, Part 2.
In the previous lecture, we explored Lewis's descriptions of the physical, moral, and political state of the innocent worlds of Malakandra and Paralandra. In this lecture, we shall watch as Lewis reenacts the full emotional, psychological, and theological dimensions of temptation and choice, as they are played out first on the unfallen world of Paralandra, and then in a small corner of our fallen Earth. Now, in our last lecture, I described Paralandra for you, and I think you would agree that Lewis's lush descriptions are truly Miltonic and epic. However, I would argue that it is in his exploration of the many dimensions of temptation that he truly waxes epic. This is where Paralandra becomes an epic. Now, just as in Eden, God used the, quote, apple to test our obedience, so on Venus, Mal-El-Dil tests the obedience and trust of the king and queen by issuing a single strange command, not to not eat a certain fruit. The command here is that although they may walk on it, they may never sleep on fixed land. They must always sleep on the floating islands. Now, as in Genesis 3, it is the woman who is tempted. It's the Eve figure who is tempted. But this time, Eve, in quotes, has a defender, Ransom, who helps to counter the arguments of the enemy. And the enemy here is Weston, who is demon-possessed. And really, Weston is Satan. There's almost no distinction as we move through the novel. Throughout the three rounds of temptation that Weston puts the queen through, she is encouraged to take her gaze off of Mal-El-Dil and put it on herself. In other words, she is tempted to focus on her own unfulfilled needs and desires. At one point, Weston tries to turn the queen into a type of woman that Lewis always said he detested. And this was a type he called the tragedy queen. What is a tragedy queen? She is a type who is always bewailing her own suffering and sacrifice, who sees herself as a martyr, a tragic pioneer. Lewis hated that, and he really used strong words. He saw it as phony and hypocritical in a way. Now, as in Screwtape Letters and The Great Divorce, I believe that Lewis shows himself here to be one of the few theological writers to understand and expound the full and exact nature of feminine as opposed to masculine sin. Lewis suggests in his works that although we sin, there are certain sins that seem more endemic to men and more endemic to women, that are more tempting. And here, Lewis, let me put it this way. Unlike misogynistic theologians, unfortunately I've got to add Augustine in there, though I love him. Unlike misogynistic theologians who falsely argue that the key female sin is carnality, they used to call women the sex, Lewis argues that the real temptation of Eve is to use pity and unselfishness as a tool for manipulation and vain egoism. Lewis showed that that was often a temptation that tempted women rather than violence or something tempting men. Now, many modern critics have accused Lewis of being misogynistic. But I would argue quite the opposite, that he's not misogynistic, but that Lewis was one of the few advocates for femininity in a distinctly unchivalrous age. He is really a knight in a certain way. And Lewis wanted to get at the essence. And let me put it this way. Most of Lewis's fans when he was writing were women. And most of the people that wrote him letters were women. And they were not just what we would call fan letters. These women wrote Lewis for advice. And he wrote back to them because they felt, I believe, that Lewis understood the difficulties of femininity in the modern world. And they wrote to him for advice. Now, Weston, what he tries to do is convince the queen that the king is stupid and sluggish and that any real initiative must come from her. Indeed, Weston said, God wants her to assert herself by sleeping on fixed land. because only then can she force the king for his own good to also be free like her. He plays on her vanity, her egoism, her need to control her husband. In the great divorce, there's one type of a woman who all her life has controlled her husband and tried to make him into something he never wanted to be. And again, she's ready to drag him from heaven down to hell so she can still, quote, take care of him. In fact, Lewis the moralist often satirized women who, quote, nobly suffered for their families when they knew their families neither needed nor desired such suffering. Lewis had this little joke where he said, look at that woman. She's the type of woman who lives for others. And Lewis would answer, yeah, you can tell by the hunted expression on the people she cares for. And again, it was something that he saw finally as hypocritical. Indeed, such disingenuousness is not only sinful because it hurts others, but because it results in a fatal inward turn that shrivels our human potential. The tragedy queen not only hurts others, she hurts herself by limiting and shriveling her humanity. Let's move on. We saw in Lecture 6 that Lewis believed that the romantic tendency to make a hero out of Milton's Satan was a gross misreading. Well, here he embodies that argument, because here in this novel, Lewis depicts Satan not as a noble, grand sufferer, a romantic hero, but as a spiteful, petty child. Weston, who remember is basically Satan, is not a Promethean sufferer who sacrificed personal comfort for knowledge. Rather, he is an empty shell of a man. Lewis calls him the unman in the novel. Weston is someone who has surrendered his will to a force that seeks not to empower, but to devour his ego. Let me give you an example of how petty Weston is. At one point of the novel, he methodically rips open the bellies of frogs. No reason to do it, it's just spite. Another thing, and again, you'll never forget this if you read the novel, to wear down Ransom, Weston will say, Ransom, 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 and when Ransom finally says what, he answers nothing. Then he starts again, Ransom, Ransom. He'll say it 1,000 times, Ransom, until he says what? Nothing, and he'll move on. He's petty and spiteful. Lewis's Satan, his Weston, again, almost the same thing, is more dead than alive, more pathetic than tragic. He has no secret knowledge that can make the queen wise. He can only extend his misery. And as you know, misery loves company. That's sort of the motto of hell in some ways. Now, up till this point, it's what you expect. Three rounds of temptation. But then, in an absolutely unexpected twist in the plot, suddenly, after helping the queen resist three rounds of temptation, Ransom realizes that Weston is going to go on tempting the queen no matter how often she rebuffs him. He realizes that if Weston is not stopped physically, that he will rattle on his cold, anti-life logic for all eternity. You pick up what I'm saying? What I'm saying is that Ransom realizes that it is now permissible, nay, imperative, that Ransom not only hate, but kill Weston. Now, this is basically a Christian novel. Suddenly, he feels that he must kill Weston. Now, many of you are saying, what about that Christian idea that you're supposed to love the sinner but hate the sin? But you're missing something here. What you're missing is that Weston has become pure corruption. He is no longer a sinner. He is only a sin. Or to use the language of an earlier lecture, he is no longer just a grumbler. He has become a grumble. And so that Christian injunction is abrogated. Ransom must kill him because all he's killing is a sin. There's no sinner left. The humanity is gone. And so, oddly, the struggle between good and evil reduces itself in the novel to two middle-aged men boxing for their life on a distant planet. And yet, maybe this is not so strange. For as Lewis tells us in Mere Christianity, in the Bible, all the miracles and covenants and kingdoms narrow themselves finally to a girl at her prayers. The girl, of course, is Mary just before the Annunciation. And Lewis believed, because he believed in free will, that Mary could have said no to God. Mary chose to go through all the, you know, possible death by taking on Christ in her body. And Lewis said that all that wild stuff that happens in the Old Testament, all those historical forces and kingdoms, narrows it down to one poor little rustic girl in a village. That's how God works, Lewis believed. And you know what? If this seems odd to you, if it seems odd that the fate of the cosmos can rest on the ordinary actions of ordinary people, then you know what? That Hideous Strength is going to be the oddest novel you ever read. That Hideous Strength is the third novel in the Space Trilogy. And in this novel, Lewis offers us an apocalyptic battle between angels and demons. But this battle is not disguised as a science fiction fantasy, as it is in Out of the Silent Planet. It's not even disguised as a Miltonic theodicy, as in Perelandra. Rather, it comes to us in the form of a realistic, domestic novel. And that's what makes it so strange. The protagonists of That Hideous Strength are neither priests nor prophets. Rather, they are an average, rather unhappy, petty bourgeois couple named Mark and Jane Studdock, the last characters you would expect in an apocalyptic good versus evil novel. Let me introduce you to our characters. Mark is a sociologist who desperately wants to enter the elite circle of his academic colleagues and who is willing to sacrifice friends and family to do so. Unfortunately, he is a type we recognize. Jane, on the other hand, is a frustrated, childless, proto-feminist working on a PhD thesis on Dunn, who resents her husband's authority and freedom and just wants to be left alone. And actually, Lewis identifies more with Jane in the novel than Mark. There's a bit of Lewis in both characters, but he identifies more with Jane in his desire to just be left alone. I've got to mention something funny here. Many people don't know this, but Lewis never went on to get a PhD. He thought PhDs were a waste of time. He thought there was nothing sillier than writing a thesis on somebody like Dunn that nobody will ever read. Technically, he's not even really Dr. Lewis. He just thought it was a waste of time. He'd rather write books that somebody wanted to read. And I find that kind of interesting as a PhD. All right, let me tell you how the plot works. Through an engrossing mirror image plot structure, Lewis takes his two protagonists, Mark and Jane, on a parallel journey that forces them to choose whom they will serve and what they will believe. And you know what? Their choices not only have personal consequences, but cosmic consequences. Our choices do have ramifications. Let's begin with Mark. Mark's journey carries him into the inner ring of NICE. NICE is a very ironic acronym that stands for the National Institute of Coordinated Experiments. And NICE is a secret society that employs Machiavellian tactics in order to establish an efficient, scientific, omnicompetent state. In other words, the abolition of man, the one where Lewis feared a dystopia controlled by controllers, that the ideas in the abolition of man are embodied fictionally in That Hideous Strength. And so, in one sense, NICE is trying to do what Lewis fears in the abolition of man, establish a totalitarian, dystopic state run by controllers. But here, Lewis is freed by the genre of science fiction, and so Lewis invests his nightmare Orwellian vision with a touch of horror. Because we soon learn that at the core of NICE is not just a desire to conquer nature, but a disgust for the physical body itself. Indeed, the crowning achievement of their anti-humanistic science is the artificial preservation of the bodiless human head of a criminal. It's a head being kept alive by tubes and test tubes and whatnot. Now, the head, as you might guess, is a ghastly symbol of cold, abstract mind severed from warm, living flesh. It's the ultimate end of people that are disgusted by the physical and want only the intellectual, rational, abstract. The head represents that. And we learn that the head actually controls the controllers, who pay it, the head, almost religious worship. But guess what? in actuality, the head and all of nice is itself controlled by demons. So we sort of move backwards till we get to the real orchestrators of this plot, if you will. And these demons, their hatred of organic life, of individuality, and of human emotion is boundless. Their image of a perfect world is the moon. Dead, cold, dark, and sterile. I remind you of something I said before. Satan is anti-life. He is anti-humanistic. Again, Satan is not the partier of the universe. He's the cosmic killjoy. And Lewis shows it here perhaps more powerfully than anywhere else in his fiction. Again, he shows that modernism finally is anti-humanistic. It's against the human. It wants something else. It wants just reason. However, the evil inherent in nice is not just demonic, because the demons couldn't do what they're doing if it wasn't for an equal evil, an evil that is human. And this evil, one that Mark falls prey to, is what Lewis calls the desire to be part of an inner ring. You'll remember in lecture one, I told you that Lewis attended a college, or a prep school really, called Malvern College. And there, he had to put up with the fagging system. Remember, where the upper class athletes, they're called the Bloods, Lewis calls them, that they basically treat the underclassmen as slaves. They make them do this for that and do this for that. And Lewis hated that. He hated the idea of the Bloods, and he hated the fagging system. Indeed, Lewis was horrified not just by the Bloods, but even more by the toadying and the self-abasement and the abject hypocrisy that accompanied the underclassmen's attempts to enter the Bloods. He was more horrified by what the young kids would do to become part of the Bloods. And until his death, and I'm serious, not being silly here, Lewis saw this ungodly lust to be on the inside as one of the great evils of humanity. He really believed a lot of evil came from the inner ring, and that's often a bureaucratic inner ring. The men in three-piece suits that order the Holocaust. That is the inner ring. And Lewis, as you might guess, contrasted that evil with our proper yearning for God. To be part of God's kingdom, that's the only inner ring we should truly seek. But when we want to be part of the human inner ring, it's often a kind of evil for Lewis. Indeed, Mark is so seduced by the chance of joining Nice's inner ring and thus becoming one of the controllers, he is so into that he actually perverts his journalistic skills and language itself to write propaganda defending Nice's illicit activities. And there's a touch here of George Orwell. Those of you that have read 1984 and know about Newspeak, where they create a language that controls people. Well, this is what Mark is doing. Again, Mark is the first person to use something like ethnic cleansing to cover up a terrible horror. Or pro-life and pro-choice, which are both euphemisms for something else. And that's what Mark is doing. And this is something our modern society has done. We have degraded language and used language to cover up great horrors often. But there's a great irony here. Mark wants to be part of the inner ring. He wants to be truly individualistic, self-serving. But you know what? If he were to successfully become a member of Nice, you know what would happen? Nice would rob him of his individuality. Bellbury is the headquarters of Nice, and I'm going to use that word from now on. At Bellbury, at the headquarters of Nice, not anybody that works at Bellbury is allowed a separate ego. We learn that all people who work at Bellbury must surrender their wills to the collective. Bellbury is basically an anthill, and Lewis hated the idea of the collective, you know, where everybody's massed together on equal terms and the same. Now, as you might guess, there is a good force. If the bad force is Bellbury, the good force is what Lewis calls the Society of St. Anne's. And it's meeting in an old convent, and it's a group of people getting together to fight the growing evil of Bellbury. And in the contrast between Bellbury and St. Anne's, we get at the core of Lewis's ideas about society. If Bellbury's model is the anthill, or as Lewis also says, the organism, where everything must serve and lose its individuality, St. Anne's is organized as a family. At Bellbury, all people are equal and therefore equally insignificant. Bellbury is a lowest common denominator world, the kind of world Lewis feared. At St. Anne's, on the other hand, there is hierarchy. But because of this hierarchy, everybody is equally vital in their position and role. They're not equal, but they're equal. They're equal because every one of them has an important position. That's how they're equal. They're equal within hierarchy. The director of Bellbury offers no leadership. He wants no responsibility. But because of that, there is constant infighting between its members. It's like a bad English faculty, let's say, where there's all this infighting and there's no leader to really stop this. But at St. Anne's, they are controlled by Ransom, who is returned from Paralandra, and Ransom is in the guise of a true biblical patriarch. And again, Lewis believed in patriarchy. In our modern day, we tend to see that as a dirty word. But patriarchy means the rule of the father. It goes back to the patriarchs like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Lewis believed that patriarchy can be good because in a good patriarch, everybody knows their place and their worth. Again, Lewis is a traditionalist, going back to an older model. Let us move on. Jane, and we'll turn over to her now, during the course of the novel, she discovers that she possesses special visionary powers given her by Mal Eldil to help combat the growing evil of Bellbury. And when St. Anne's learns this, they invite Jane to join them, their society, and also to join forces with them to fight Bellbury. But Jane learns that to join St. Anne's, she must learn to give of herself in two ways. One, by submitting to the proper authority of God, Ransom, and her husband, and by accepting her role as a creature, as something created. Now, again, a lot of modernists attack Lewis for his view, his sort of traditional view of the family, and its traditional view of hierarchy. But I would argue that Lewis is not a woman hater or a misogynist. Rather, he is feminine affirming. He wants to affirm the role. Let's put it this way. A lot of modern Christians believe the Bible is egalitarian. Men and women are the same. Lewis believed in an older model that they are complementary. Men and women are different, but equally vital and worthy in God's eyes. That, I believe, is what Lewis is doing. He is feminine affirming rather than woman bashing. And she must learn that she's got to take her place in a hierarchy. All right. Finally, in the walled garden of St. Anne's, Jane finally yields herself to God the lover, and by so doing is enabled to become both a free, unique individual and a full, real person. And that wonderful conversion in the garden should remind you of Augustine's conversion in the Confessions, but it's also modeled after Lewis's own conversion. Let's go back now to Mark, because you see, Mark's initiation rite at Bellbury is quite different. To prepare Mark to reject Christ and accept the head, he's actually have to step on the cross, and to accept the head, Mark is thrown into a lopsided room whose function is to disrupt all normal standards and thus pervert Mark's natural human reactions. Throw him in a room where nothing makes sense. Look at the contrast. St. Anne invites Jane into a world of love, beauty, and purpose. Bellbury, on the other hand, seduces Mark to embrace a nihilistic, surreal, atonal world free of all absolutes, the world you get when you throw out the towel. And guess what? Here, as in all of Lewis, the decision whether or not to embrace Christianity is not merely a theological one. It is actually a choice between reality and illusion. Between the natural and the unnatural, the straight and the crooked, the light and the dark. This is a real dualistic novel in terms of good and evil. Now, in human terms, the strength of Bellbury is immense. How do you beat Bellbury? Well, St. Anne's has Ransom. But he's a different ransom than in the first two novels. Gone is the physical, martial ransom of Paralandra and Out of the Silent Planet. The man we meet who runs St. Anne's is a sedate figure who rules by spiritual strength of character. In fact, we learn that Ransom, he's not a warrior anymore, he is actually in intermittent pain from a wound in his heel that he received in his struggle with Weston in Paralandra, with the unman. Now, this image is packed. Most of you know in Genesis 3, the first prophecy of Christ says that the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent will fight. The seed of the serpent will pierce the heel or bite the heel of the seed of the woman, but her seed will crush his head. And it's most Christians consider it a prophecy of Christ because Satan bit him in the heel when he was crucified, but then Jesus crushed his head in the resurrection. But there's something else. Those of you who know about Arthurian legends, and C.S. Lewis was a bit of an Arthurian scholar, will know that part of the Arthurian legends is the Fisher King, someone who has been wounded, and as he is wounded, his whole land is dying. In other words, Ransom calls together not only Christian ideals, but he brings in Arthurian legends. Indeed, in the person of Ransom, Lewis pulls together the full mythic weight of the scapegoat king and invests it with a historical reality. Ransom is a scapegoat both in the Christian and in the Arthurian sense. And of course, King Arthur is supposed to be a Christian king in some ways. Now, in Paralandra, Ransom quite literally becomes the Christ of Venus. He really becomes the Messiah of Venus. In that hideous strength, however, he is less a Christ figure and he is more Arthur the Pendragon, the great Christian king whose court of Camelot is the one shining light in a dark world. Now, we call it Camelot. Lewis always called it Logris, but it basically means the same thing for our purpose. In fact, as we analyze Ransom, the Pendragon, the leader of Logris, we discover, or Lewis tells us, that there is not one England, but there are actually two Englands. The first England is the unheroic nation of shopkeepers, and that's Britain. That's the, you know, people that just seek their creature comforts. But the second one is the heroic nation of poets, the England of Shakespeare and Chaucer. This is Logris. Now, we learn in the novel that Logris exists within Britain. In other words, the heroic England lives inside of the unheroic England, and the heroic England is ever waiting to break through and redeem Britain from her drunken sleep. See how Lewis not only puts it on a cosmological scheme, but on a sort of historical, eschatological scheme. And Lewis, I believe, would say that all countries have two countries within them. So Belbury is the bad England, if you will. St. Anne's is the good England. Here's another twist. The final redemption in that hideous strength, because don't worry, the good guys win. The redemption is heralded in the novel by the physical awakening and return of Merlin, because some believe that not only is King Arthur asleep at Avalon waiting to return, but Merlin is also in a sleep. Actually, we find out that Arthur and Merlin are sleeping on Venus. Isn't that interesting? But anyway, Merlin is called back to life, and Ransom takes his dark, earthy magic and channels it for good. You want to know something funny? Merlin is based on William Butler Yeats in the novel. Lewis actually said that. He patterned him after Yeats. Well, let's come to the end. The novel's strange title, That Hideous Strength, refers to the arrogance of the builders of the Tower of Babel. It comes from an old poem. And in the climax, Ransom, by the power of Merlin and the Oyarsa of Mercury, literally babbles the tongues of Belbury and ushers in their swift, bloody destruction. That Hideous Strength is maybe not a book for children, because the ending is very, very bloody. Because what happens is, when their languages are babbled, all of the Belbury people literally fall on each other and devour each other. It's a rather grotesque end, but Lewis wants to show how evil in the end devours itself. Again, this is a novel well worth reading. In fact, at the end of the novel, all of the planets actually descend and allow their virtues to help St. Anne to overcome the evil forces. So it's a truly cosmic ending. But I want to end on the note I began, and that's to tell you that for Lewis, the choices of ordinary individuals is what makes all the difference.